Palestinians holding a funeral for a resistance fighter killed during an Israeli attack on his house in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Nasrallah says Israel cannot even dream of plundering Lebanon's resources because Hezbollah will never allow that to happen. An Iranian satellite Hayam aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket blasts off from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Palestinians are mourning the death of Ibrahim al-Nablusi, an Islamic Jihad fighter who was killed during an Israeli raid on his house in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinians say that his death will not cause the resistance to back down.
No, they didn't win. There are hundreds of Ibrahims. There are a million of Ibrahims. There are millions of Ibrahims. There isn't just one Ibrahim in the world. No, any Palestinian himself is Ibrahim.
Al-Nablusi, commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, was killed after regime forces fired a rocket at his house. The raid also triggered an exchange of fire between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. And that left two more Palestinians dead and scores of others, including a woman, wounded. Meantime, Hamas resistance movement says that Palestinians are united in their fight against Israel until they bring an end to the occupation. The Israeli military has been conducting deadly raids almost on a daily basis in the occupied lands. The regime forces often resort to live fire against Palestinians protesting against Israeli atrocities. Mona Kendall joined us a short while ago to give us some more details on the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
The Israeli military revealed that the main aim of the operation was to kill Ibrahim al-Nablusi, who evaded numerous assassinations in the past, and a number of his friends were killed by the Israeli soldiers in Nablus. But this time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to kill this Palestinian fighter who was seen by many Palestinians as a hero. His friend also, his friend was also killed during this operation. Islam Sbouh, 25 years old, and there is another Palestinian, a third Palestinian actually, a teenager, 16-year-old, Hussein Jamal Taha, was shot dead during this operation. As you have mentioned, we are speaking also about over 40 Palestinians were wounded during this operation. The aim of the Israeli military was to kill Palestinian fighters. It was the same aim of the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip, to kill Palestinian leaders of the jihad movement.
Saad Nimr is a political science professor at the Birzeit University, and he says that Israel has intensified attacks against Palestinians out of desperation and in the face of growing strength of the resistance front.
That Israeli, they noticed in the last few months that there was a growth of the Palestinian resistance in the cities, such as in Jenin and in Nablus, and maybe that will be copied also to other cities. And that was very much alarming for the Israelis. Part of the operation was in the war on Gaza against Islamic Jihad, because the focus on Jenin refugee camp usually and the arrest of Bassam al-Saadi because of the Islamic Jihad brigade which are in Jenin. Now this is alarming for the Israelis, and they want to eliminate the Palestinian armed resistance that exists in Jenin and in Nablus, because they are afraid really that will be copied in all other cities. And in such case, the Israeli will have a problem in arresting and wandering around, and that will give a growth to the Palestinian armed resistance, which we started to witness. witness in the last few months in more and more operations against the Israelis and resistance when they come to the refugee camp or to Nablus. Recently in Nablus there was many clashes, armed clashes with the Israeli when they arrived at the city of Nablus in many occasions. So now it is about time from their point of view to eliminate the Palestinians.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it will not allow Israel to even dream about plundering the nation's resources. Citizen Nasrallah warned the regime against miscalculating Lebanon's resolve, and that amid a maritime dispute over Israel's attempt to take control of Karish gas field in the Mediterranean. Nasrallah was addressing hundreds of mourners commemorating Ashura. The Hezbollah chief said the resistance is the only way to the liberation of the Israeli-occupied territories. He reaffirmed support for the Palestinian cause. He also slammed as shameful the move by a number of Arab states to normalize ties with Israel. Nasrallah said that Bahrain is a case in point for oppressing its own Muslim population while welcoming Israeli officials. Millions of Muslims in several countries are marking Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Iraqis converged on Imam Hussein's shrine in the city of Karbala to show their grief and perform mourning rituals. People also gathered in mourning processions in the capital, Baghdad. They also rallied in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to commemorate the sacrifices of Imam Hussein and his companions on Ashura. The occasion has also been marked in different cities in Canada. The martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein was marked in Iran on Monday. Ashura is the 10th day of the lunar calendar month of Muharram. It's the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred on the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. Muslims in Austria also came out in large numbers to add their voices of grief to the millions of mourners across the globe. Robert Carter, correspondent, traveled to Vienna to witness local Muslims honor the legacy of the martyred grandson of Islam's beloved prophet.
Shia Muslims living across Austria have joined in global commemorations as the Muslim world marks the day of Ashura. Ashura is the emotional peak of the 10 days mourning period to mark the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. He was slain by the forces of the tyrannical ruler Yazid ibn Muawiyah on the plains of modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala, nearly 1,400 years ago.
This historic tragedy was sparked after Imam Hussein led a revolution to depose a corrupt regime of his time headed by tyrant Yazid. Many historians believe that without the Imam's great sacrifice, Islam as we know it could have become totally corrupted.
Today we're also met with a lot of injustice, and that's what Imam Hussein stood against. And that's why it's important to follow him still.
He was trying to bring back the deviated path that Muslims had been taking for quite a long time. But when you look at it from a universal scale, you see that that was all for humanity and freedom if we read more deeply about it. It all depends on how much you study about his journey that he took from Medina to Karbala, and then the way he was killed, and that he never submitted, he never gave up, he never gave in to their demands.
He stood for the rights of people and helped them a lot, and yes, that's what I can only spread. If you're against injustice, then you can stand with Imam Hussein.
These scenes of passionate remembrance prove that any hope Hussein's killers had of snuffing out his revolution were a total failure, as Hussein's name continues to ring out across the world, even as far as Europe and beyond. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Now, Karim Sharar, an Islamic scholar from Guam, elaborates on Imam Hussein's message of resistance against injustice and tyranny. Let's take a listen.
The Battle of Ashura basically lifted religion up from very dire straits again. So when you see the oppression that exists all around the world, our main takeaway from this, from everything that's happened over the past 1400 years, is that by reviving or by remembering what happened to Imam Hussein and his companions, and by consoling ourselves with the fact that even in the most dire of circumstances, he was able eventually to become victorious through the message that he wanted to spread, we find some sort of solace in our oppression and in rising up against this oppression, against, I mean, when we rise up for justice, for social justice, when we're brought down, I mean, repeatedly, again and again. Look at the resistance in Lebanon, for example. The resistance in Lebanon back in 1982, despite the oppression, despite everything we were up against, we were able, through the grace of God, to lift this oppression up, and then we had the liberation of the year 2000. Again, 2000, 2006, 2011, 2012, 13, 14, 16, 18, and up till now, every year, every time we've been able to, we stood against oppression, we stood on the side of justice, we put our faith in God and managed to go forward, God eventually granted us victory. This is how we view the uprising of Imam Hussein.
In other news, an Iranian satellite has been launched into orbit by a Russian Soyuz rocket from the Baikonur space station in Kazakhstan. The satellite, called Hayam, is a remote sensing apparatus that will take high-quality pictures for use in environmental and agricultural research and also monitoring of water resources. The Iranian Minister of Communication and Information says that the launch is the beginning of a strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow in the field of space. Russia has also put an Iranian satellite into space in 2005. Iran says a final agreement in the talks to restore the 2015 nuclear deal must guarantee the rights of the country as well as the enduring and effective removal of sanctions. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the announcement in a phone conversation with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, and that after the latest round of talks in Vienna. The top diplomat said that Tehran has relayed its views and considerations about EU's proposals to resolve outstanding issues. Amir Abdullahian pointed to Iran's constructive initiatives in the talks and stressed seriousness and determination to achieve a deal. He urged the other sides, the U.S. in particular, to adopt a realistic approach and refrain from unconstructive stances to pave the way for an agreement. Now, Borrell also assessed the recent Vienna talks as positive, as that relative progress was made. Russia's envoy to the talks said that the participants now need to decide if the text submitted by the EU is acceptable.
The EU coordinator circulated the final text of the draft decision on restoration of the JCPOA. The participants in the Vienna talks now need to decide if the draft is acceptable for them. In case of no objection, the nuclear deal will be restored.
The United States also says it's ready to quickly conclude a deal based on the EU's proposal. Iran says it's too soon to talk about a final text, and nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. The nuclear deal known as the JCPOA was derailed after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Indirect talks have been going on in Vienna since April last year for the readmission of the U.S. to the deal and its restoration. Our correspondent in Vienna, Robert Carter, has interviewed Mohammed Mirandi, an advisor to Iran's negotiating team, about the Vienna talks and the reviving the 2015 deal. Mirandi says that Iran has been able to make remarkable achievements due to its resilience throughout the talks.
The remaining issues are limited, but they're still very important. For example, the IAEA is an important issue. We have to keep in mind that the IAEA Board of Governors is not a technical body. It's a political body. And it's dominated by Western countries. They have an extraordinarily large amount of influence on the board. And we saw that before the previous board meeting, the IAEA chief went to Israel. So it's not a technical body. For Iran, the issue has to be resolved, the issue between Iran and the IAEA, in a meaningful way. There's also the issue of guarantees. Investors who come to Iran or who want to come to Iran have to feel secure. If the Americans, after 2 months, decide to pull out of the deal, for whatever reason, we have bad experiences with the United States. They're not trustworthy. They're not reliable. So what if the Americans sign a deal and then after a couple of months they decide to leave? Those investors who entered the Iranian market during that period, are they safe and secure? The Americans initially said no. They said they're on their own. During these months, it gradually went from 0 to 6 months, then to a year, then to 2 years. Right now, I don't want to talk about the final text, but we have a situation that has to be analyzed and decided whether it is enough or not. So you have guarantees, you have the issue of the IAEA, you have the issue of sanctions, what sanctions impede the normalization of the Iranian economy. So all of these have to be discussed in Tehran and in other capitals as a package, and then a response given to the other members of the at the negotiating table.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Liz Truss suffered a humiliating setback in her bid to become the next Prime Minister on Tuesday, 9th of August, as she was forced into a U-turn on civil service pay after a backlash from within her own party. The Foreign Secretary swiftly abandoned the cornerstone of her plan for a war on Whitehall waste when it was revealed it could lead to pay cuts for millions of teachers, nurses and police officers. The article you're about to hear has been written by Guardian columnists Heather Stewart and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Truss Suffers Setback as Criticism of Civil Service Pay Plan Brings U-Turn. Liz Truss suffered a humiliating setback in her bid to become the next Prime Minister of Britain on Tuesday, as she was forced into a U-turn on civil service pay after a backlash from within her own party. The Foreign Secretary swiftly abandoned the cornerstone of her plan for a war on Whitehall waste when it was revealed it could lead to pay cuts for millions of teachers, nurses and police officers. The Foreign Secretary had proposed creating regional pay boards to set civil sector pay, matching it more closely to local labour markets outside of London and the southeast of England. But it was scrapped within hours after analysts pointed out the purported £8.8 billion saving from the policy was only remotely achievable by cutting wages across the public sector. With ballot papers dropping this week, Liz Truss is widely regarded as the front-runner in the race to succeed Boris Johnson. But one new opinion poll put her just 5 percentage points ahead of Rishi Sunak, while Conservative MPs say many members remain undecided. The Teesside Mayor, Ben Hoochan, a popular figure within the Conservative Party and its Rishi Sunak backer, said he was speechless at the policy, which he said would work against the flagship Conservative policy of levelling up. There is simply no way you can do this without a massive pay cut for 5.5 million people, including nurses, police officers and our armed forces outside of London. So much that we've worked for in places like Teesside would be undone, he said. Red Wall MPs, including Jacob Young and Richard Holden, had also raised alarm at the policy announced overnight, as well as the former Cabinet Minister Simon Hart, who said it would amount to cuts of nearly £3,000 for workers in Wales. Liz Truss abruptly withdrew the policy on Tuesday, little more than 12 hours after it had been floated, claiming in an awkward interview that it had been misrepresented. There has never any intention to affect teachers and nurses, but I don't want to worry people. I don't want people to be concerned. So I'm being very clear that we will not be going ahead with the regional pay boards, she told ITV. Asked if the move was a U-turn, Liz Truss said, I'm someone who is honest and upfront, and I do what I say I will do, and I'm being clear, I will not be doing that. Liz Truss had previously appeared to be cruising to victory in the race, picking up the support of cabinet colleagues Ben Wallace and Brandon Lewis, and her former leadership rivals Penny Mordaunt and Tom Tugendhat in recent days. Rishi Sunak, meanwhile, has announced a series of increasingly hardline promises in a bid to stay in the race, including capping the number of refugees, doubling the number of foreign criminals deported, and taking on what he called left-wing agitators in a culture war over gender identity. His campaign team responded to Liz Truss's statement with barely disguised glee, with a spokesperson claiming the misstep showed a lack of serious judgment and a worrying lack of grip on detail in what is already a woolly economic plan. If this was in a general election, it would have been a potentially fatal own goal for the Conservatives, they added, suggesting that Liz Truss has supported the policy since 2018 when she was Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Several Sunak supporters compared the turn of events to Theresa May's dementia tax, the deeply unpopular plan to fund social care that contributed to the Tories losing their majority in the 2017 general election. Mark Harper, a former chief whip who is supporting Rishi Sunak, said scrapping the proposal also meant there was now an £8.8 billion hole in Liz Truss's tax and spending plans. An economic policy that can't be paid for isn't very conservative. Mrs. Thatcher would be livid, he said, accusing Liz Truss of blaming journalists for misconstruing her plans. The Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey said U-turning on a multi-billion pound policy 5 weeks before even taking office must be a new record. We can't let Liz Truss run the country with the same incompetence she's running her leadership campaign. The British people must have their say in a general election. Meanwhile, the Labour Party said the original plan would have meant a £7.1 billion hit to local economies across Yorkshire, the North and the Midlands. Angela Rayner, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, said Liz Truss is a liability who has lingered in this Tory cabinet for nearly a decade in which the Tories have fuelled a cost-of-living crisis. Alex Thomas, a programme director at the Institute for Government think tank, pointed out that the whole annual civil service pay bill was about £9 billion. Tony Wilson, director of the Institute for Employment Studies, said Liz Truss's policy appeared to date back to a time when public sector pay outstripped the private sector's. But the latest data showed it was at £20 a week lower on average. The new leadership opinion poll, including 807 Conservative members, was conducted by Techni for a private client and showed just a 5 percentage point gap between the two candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. Separate polling by YouGov for the Times on Tuesday before the U-turn had the Foreign Secretary with a huge 34-point lead and a 60% of the membership saying they would vote for her. Liz Truss gained the backing of the Daily Mail on Tuesday, having already won the support of the Telegraph. Signs her public sector pay policy was in difficulty began on Tuesday morning when Jacob Rees-Mogg, a backer of Truss and the minister in charge of civil service efficiency, said it was not the plan at the moment to cut pay for the wider public sector to make savings of £8.8 billion promised by Truss. The discussion at the moment is around civil servants, he said. In the original release, which proposed regional pay boards, Liz Truss said she would tailor pay to the cost of living where civil servants actually work, and this would save up to £8.8 billion. It said the policy could be adopted for all public sector workers in the long term.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Imam al-Nas wal-Jinnah, Ali hubbuhu junnah, وصيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وصيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, and here Imam Ali alayhi salam draws out the strategy that he has in mind with regards to the change that is required in the society, in the Islamic Ummah, that was going through a very tough time of redundancy because of the very wrong and wretched policies that were in place in the previous governments. And now it was Imam Ali alayhi salam's role to reverse this whole thing and to recalibrate it in the right direction. And Imam Ali alayhi salam then says something beautiful, and he says that these mistakes that and these wrong and false policies that the previous governments were holding on to were the reason why the community was being drowned in corruption and destruction and into the fire. And he gave the example of those horses and everything that I discussed previously, inshallah. Those who are interested can refer back to the previous session.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about this beautiful parable that Imam Ali alayhi salam gives here in this example, when he talks about the fact that those people who are pious, a community that is pious, that holds on to policies that are based on truth, that hold on to policies that are based on piety. Piety here meaning that they are cautious. They are sensitive about what is correct and what is not. They are aware. They are careful. They are protective of what is correct. This is the meaning of taqwa. And those who are like that, it's as if they have climbed, they have mounted a tame horse. And such a this tame horse has got its reins and allows its rider to hold on to the reins. And then together it takes the people into heaven. So look, Imam Ali alayhi salam says when a person does not have piety, if the society holds on to policies that are not based on piety, this society is like it's climbed on horses that are very wild, and they will take you to the worst direction and just throw you and you can't even control them. But if a person climbs on piety, that means if a person bases his whole society in piety, on piety, on being careful, on, you know, being sensitive about what is right and what is wrong, in being cautious, yes, it is difficult, but it is as if you as a community have mounted on a horse that is tame and that is giving you its reins. That means you are in control, because when you are pious, you are basing your life on something divine, on true principles, on things that are correct, on principles that God is aware of, and God gives barakah and blessings to those things, which is actually the reason why the universe is alive and is continuing to grow. So when you base yourself on those, then as if you're in a very calm horse, and it gives you its reins and it takes you to heaven. But on the other hand, if you just base your life, base your whole country and your whole society on false, wretched, destructive policies, then it's as if you are on a wild and uncontrollable horse. Because why is it wild and uncontrollable? Because that's how mistakes are. That's how wrongdoings are. That's how impiety is. It is not firmly based on any true reality in the universe. And therefore, it takes you into the worst directions of destruction.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam beautifully says, أَلَا وَإِنَّ التَّقْوَى مَطَايَا ذُلُلٌ حُمِلَ عَلَيْهَا أَهْلُهَا. That verily piety, being cautious, being careful, being concerned about the right and the wrong and taking that true path. Piety is such that it is like مَطَايَا ذُلُلٌ, like a mount which is humble. حُمِلَ عَلَيْهَا أَهْلُهَا, whereby its people, that community that follows these principles of piety, they climb on it. They can stay on it. They are allowed to climb it. وَأُعْطُوا أَزِمَّتَهَا, and they are given the reins to control it. To go where? فَأَوْرَدَتْهُمُ الْجَنَّةِ, and it takes them to heaven. So when this society follows these principles, you can imagine where it goes. These words are so beautiful, so powerful, that our scholars, they say that it is not possible for a human being to just explain them so easily. These examples, these parables that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions are superb in their articulation. They are mesmerizing in the way they, you know, cause a fervor in the heart. They awaken the deepest spiritual feelings towards the right things and the right thoughts and the right principles. These are the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the peak of eloquence. This is the statements from the master of the believers and the commander of the faithful. This is Imam Ali alayhi salam. And when Imam Ali alayhi salam decides to speak the truth, when Imam Ali alayhi salam decides to take the path of justice, when Imam Ali alayhi salam wishes to analyze a society, then you have a master in his field, you know, taking all those details and bringing about that right worldview and the right thought in trying to create the right change that is required for the society. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. If Donald Trump or any of the likely U.S. Republican nominees win in 2024 presidential election, they will immediately move to protect those who attempted to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Lawrence Tribe and Dennis Aftergut. The piece is titled, Time is Running Out. The U.S. Department of Justice must indict and convict Trump. Recently, CNN reported that key January 6 texts have been erased by officials of former U.S. President Donald Trump's Defense Department, in addition to Homeland Security and the Secret Service. Not even a clueless Hamlet could avoid smelling something rotten in the state of Denmark. With the growing list of deletions, there is a whole new criminal conspiracy to investigate. One to destroy evidence of the grave federal crimes already under investigation. Nothing so focuses the prosecutorial mind or underscores the need to accelerate a criminal investigation as evidence that the investigation's target may have plotted to erase the proof of his wrongdoing that is needed to hold him accountable. The Attorney General Merrick Garland knows that the fish always rots from the head. On 26th of July, the Washington Post broke news that the Justice Department's investigation is focused on Donald Trump himself. Time is of the essence in bringing his case to indictment. Indeed, a moving target who gives every indication that he plans to strike again must trigger a different cost-benefit calculus in the inevitable debates both within and outside the Justice Department about when enough proof has been gathered to indict responsibly, and when it would be a dereliction of duty to delay further. The former president's insistence that he has nothing to be remorseful about other than not marching to the Capitol makes that debate seem academic, and the steps being taken at his behest even now in battleground states to replace 2020's failure with 2024's success redouble the urgency. Shakespeare's Brutus had it right when he said, in Julius Caesar, we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. Under these circumstances, prudence counsels running the clock backwards to set clear benchmarks for moving forward. Any calculation of how to proceed must start with two pessimistic premises. First of all, that Donald Trump will run in 2024 and could even win. Second, that if any of the likely Republican nominees win, the next administration will be one that is eager to scrap any prosecution of the last administration. We'll be right back. the goal must be to secure a conviction before November of 2024, and in any event, no later than 20th of January 2025, when the next presidential term begins. It is already too late for all appeals from any such conviction to be exhausted by that date. But the key to holding the chief conspirator accountable is a jury verdict of guilt. Consider this. The trial of insurrectionist Guy Refit occurred 13 months after his original indictment. That trial and its delaying pre-trial motions were incalculably less complex than Donald Trump's would be. One can easily anticipate motions that, if denied, might go far up the appellate chain. It is not hard to imagine a majority of Supreme Court justices in no great hurry to resolve motions upon which the start of trial could depend. One can easily convince a 20-month or longer period with the former president indicted but not yet tried. If Donald Trump is not formally charged until January of 2023, that would imply a multi-month trial starting in September or October. Should he run for president and win in November, Americans would have a president-elect in the middle of a criminal trial. Part of why a lengthy post-indictment pre-verdict period is foreseeable is that federal district courts are bound to protect an accused's rights to full airing of pre-trial claims and the time needed to file and argue them. Donald Trump will have many pre-trial claims, setting out his serial and inexhaustible list of grievances, the imagined violation of his rights, his purported immunity from prosecution as a former president, and the overriding unfairness of it all. Some district court judges, more than others, will balance protections for the accused with accountability's pragmatic need for speed. Importantly, even the four Trump-appointed district court judges in Washington, D.C. have often shown little sympathy for those charged with perpetrating the events of 6th of January 2021 or resisting their investigation. On 1st of August, Judge Dabney Friedrich sentenced Refit to more than 7 years in prison, the longest sentence to date. Judge Tim Kelly refused to dismiss indictments against Proud Boys leaders who were part of the January 6 siege. Judge Carl Nichols brooked no nonsense in Steve Bannon's July trial, deliberately preventing it from becoming the political circus that Steve Bannon sought to make it. On the other hand, among eight judges who have considered defendants' motions to dismiss federal charges of obstructing an official government proceeding, Congress's 6th of January election certification session, Judge Nichols was the lone outlier who dismissed the count. That is one of the main charges that observers believe federal prosecutors could bring against Donald Trump. The point is that if Donald Trump were to be indicted, the Department of Justice cannot count on a favorable judge putting it on a jet stream to an actual trial. So what does that mean for precisely when Donald Trump must be formally indicted? Thankfully, it doesn't imply the impossible. The Department of Justice could pull an experienced prosecutor or two from every U.S. attorney's office and put them together on the case. With all stops pulled, prosecutors still have time to do what is needed before the year end. The tasks include talking to witnesses and the January 6th House Committee interviewed and deposed, which is well underway. Cassidy Hutchinson, principal aide to Donald Trump's Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and Vice President Mike Pence's top aides, Mark Short and Greg Jacobs, are now working with the Department of Justice or appearing before its grand jury. Cooperation is already reported to have begun among the lawyer enablers of Trump's coup plotting. With the investigation's accelerating aim at Trump, every potential target's defense counsel has surely discussed with the target the advantages of an early offer to plead guilty and cooperate. Early birds get better worms. On 2nd of August, the federal grand jury investigating the lead-up to the January 6th insurrection subpoenaed the former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. Department of Justice prosecutors are reported to be preparing to go to court to secure his testimony about his conversations with Donald Trump if Cipollone again declines to disclose them on grounds of executive privilege. The task ahead is massive, but if attacked with supreme urgency, it can get done. The building blocks for a trial of Donald Trump must be put into place with alacrity. In no case more than this one, the perfect cannot be the enemy of the good. The clock is indeed ticking.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This hadith is about the punishment of God. And in this hadith, Imam Hussein alayhi salam explains a little bit about the punishment of God and asks God to save him from this punishment. As you know, we are in the month of Muharram, which is a very sacred and holy, as well as a very sad and solemn month. In this month, the hearts weep for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions and his family. In order to better benefit from this month, it behooves us to look at not only the story of Imam Hussein, what transpired on that day, the events that led up to that day, and then also the events that event led to subsequently, but also look at the message of Imam Hussein, why he rose up, as well as, in general terms, the wisdom that Imam Hussein imparted to us and which has been related to us and has been narrated by narrators of traditions from him. One of those traditions is this beautiful hadith that we would like to recite for you today. Imam Hussein alayhi salam said the following, Allahumma, O God, la tastadrijni bil ihsan. As you know, one of the concepts which has often been mentioned in the Quranic sciences is the concept of istidraj. Istidraj is a concept which has been mentioned in the Quran. It refers to the fact that God Almighty gives people blessings continuously with the hopes of their increasing in their punishment. Like, for example, let's say that somebody is given a blessing, and instead of being thankful for it, he is ungrateful for it. God Almighty, sometimes in order to, increase the punishment of this person, he keeps giving this person blessings so that his ungratefulness can increase, and eventually the punishment for this person will be so great, that it will be a great punishment. This is a concept we call istidraj. So here in this beautiful hadith, Imam Hussein alayhi salam asks God not to perform this act, with him. Then the Imam, in continuation, says, "Wala tu'addibni bil bala." Do not rectify me. Do not train me. Do not better me by means of calamities. Right? If you want to train me, if you want to better me, then do so in other means. Right? This beautiful hadith has been narrated in Bihar al-Anwar, the famous book of traditions, volume 75, page 127, and it is the ninth hadith there. So in general terms, Imam Hussein alayhi salam in this beautiful hadith asks God not to deceive him and increase his punishment by means of the continuous and successive granting of blessings, and also not to rectify his nature and his morals by means of calamities. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the punishment of God in the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
The stark warning from the Bank of England on the UK's economy. Not only will the UK economy face a contraction, will enter a year-long recession. This has forced the